the two speakers, Professor Clark Pinnock of Regent College, a theological college affiliated with the university, and Professor Dennis Chitting of the Department of Zoology here. My friends have agreed that Clark Pinnock would speak first. I now invite Professor Pinnock to speak to you.
Well, I'm delighted to be able to speak and to have this dialogue with my friend. Humanism, secular or Christian? Let me begin with a definition. I'd like to define humanism in a manner common to both of us, namely, a position that entertains a belief in the dignity and worth of human life, and as a result, sustains a ethical commitment to the well-being of other people. A general definition. The question that is before us is how we may sustain that kind of confidence in the worthwhileness of life and the ethical commitment arising out of it. What are the foundations for it? Does secularism, humanism have a basis for its humanism? Does the Christian faith have one? How do they relate? The relevance of this topic is, of course, the fact that both of us recognize that there are very serious threats to this confidence. There is a widespread loss of meaningfulness to human life, a sense of uneasiness and futility in the authors you could think of. There is a paralyzing moral relativism abroad, where values, including these humanist ones, are up for grabs and not at all obtain a consensus. And there are also waves of inhumanity and cruelty, if anything, intensifying in our day. So therefore, I take it that it is very important to ask whether there are foundations for a more humane confidence in man's worth. My thesis is that I do not understand how it can possibly be sustained adequately on a secular basis, though of course I admire secular humanists and wish them the best, but I don't see the foundations for it. It seems to me we need the good news of Jesus Christ. I have three discrete reasons for that in unpacking that thesis. Number one, according to secular humanism, there is no purpose of order back of our individual human lives. There are no ultimate ends, only finite means. There is, in short, no ultimate significance or final significance for anything. And it seems to me that our artists and writers who are not at all Christian have picked this up accurately, that the painful art of Francis Bacon, the plays of a Samuel Beckett like Waiting for Godot, and the man who stands behind much of that in the last century, Friedrich Nietzsche, show that there is a profound crisis as to do with our commitment to human things. There is emptiness, a sense of futility and boredom abroad. And we cannot expect people to pretend that it is otherwise. We cannot expect them to accept a humane commitment to life and to one another by faith. We must have a more secure ground than that. And it seems to me that what we need is the ground that the gospel of Jesus Christ supplies. Because the gospel enables us to understand man as created in the image of God, not the product of blind chance, as loved by God with an everlasting concern, and whose life participates in an ultimate purposeful order, that this is the best possible basis for our humanism, that it gives us a ground for it and a point of reference outside ourselves, without which I do not know how it can last. Second point, secular humanism creates profound difficulties for the ethical values that we associate with that. It seems to me a very germane question to ask: if my own life is the only ultimate value I have, why I should greatly care for my neighbor? It seems to me more rational, though perhaps not more intuitive, that depends on one's culture and heritage, but it seems to me more rational in our day of increasing hunger and poverty to defend one's rights against the neighbors, if indeed one's life is the only value there is. I noticed colorful review of two recent books that are on the bestsellers list, Robert Ringer's Winning Through Intimidation, number 5, and Korda's Power, How to Get It and Use It, these two delightful quotes, which seem to me quite compatible with a secular way of looking at things, from Robert Ringer, "Learn to ignore your altruistic instincts." And from Korda, "My argument is with people who do not view the world cynically." So while I do not admire those positions, far from it, and although I am no admirer of Ayn Rand's virtue of selfishness, nor of a theory of lifeboat ethics, whereby we keep what we've got and push the others aside, nor do I sympathize with Sartre's quip, "Hell is other people." Not at all. Nor do I suggest that secular humanists themselves do not live selfless lives and that I admire. My problem does not lie in that area. It lies understanding why that is so. What framework makes sense of this kind of commitment in the light of the moral vacuum that has arisen, it seems to me, right out of the humanist premises themselves? It would be nice to believe in humane values in this kind of world. I wonder how we can. And that brings me again to the gospel. The Christian knows who the neighbor is, created by God, loved by him, a neighbor to whom I have a built-in, not always easy, but a fundamental and logical commitment. A Christian does not have to pretend when he takes on his humane and humanist values. Whereas I'm wondering how the secular humanist explains his position, though I admire it. It has to do with understanding, not with any lack of admiration that moves me to raise the point. And finally, secular humanism has always had problem with the twistedness of man's being. Julian Huxley once said in a famous line, "What we have faith in is the capabilities and possibilities of man." That seems to me remarkably blind faith. The kind of faith that indeed I do not, as a Christian, ask of anyone in connection with the gospel. A faith that cannot survive the devastating critique of it, like by a Voltaire and Candide, or indeed of the daily newspaper. It is a neglect of the twistedness of man, and therefore a neglect of an interest in a solution to the twistedness. It seems to me that the Bible and the Christian message is both more realistic as to the twistedness and more hopeful about the possible outcome. The Bible recognizes that there is a deep moral problem within us, the worship of our own selves and importance, and that it offers, in the place of that, forgiveness through the gospel, God having put us right with himself. And furthermore, it offers new life, as it did to Nicodemus. It offers a new being to him if he will put his life in the hands of God and the gospel. It seems to me that if we are serious about recognizing the twistedness of ourselves, not to mention the race, that the gospel offer to put things right, while not a simplistic solution, is an offer that should not be ignored. So for these three reasons, then, I suggest that we take very seriously the claim of Christ and the gospel. It offers a foundation for our humanism. It offers us a basis of commitment to the neighbor. And furthermore, it offers us a solution to our own twistedness in the power of God by the Holy Spirit. Christianity, I think, not institutional Christianity, but the biblical message, offers a very secure footing for a lasting human commitment. Belief in God, I think, at least for me, does not lessen my concern for human things. It enhances them because it puts it within a greater and wider framework. A framework which I think we need.
Mr. Chairman, my honorable dialogue holder, ladies and gentlemen, I'd first of all like to say how much I appreciate the fact that you have entrusted me the task of defending secular humanism. This is a great challenge, and I'm worthy to accept it. Also, I find it remarkably embarrassing that there are so many people in this audience. Now, I am used to talking about things about which I'm at least supposed to know something, and on those occasions, hardly anybody shows up. So I have to compliment your publicity section on drawing in a crowd from all quarters of the campus to check up on my misplaced ideas. Now, first of all, I would like to assure the group of Christian clubs who have issued this invitation that some of my very best friends are Christians. But I also know a number of other people who hold other faiths, and I'm afraid an even larger number who are dwelling in spiritual darkness and whose long-term prospects are, to say the least, uncertain. But it seems to me that in our ordinary course of affairs, we don't really know which group these people belong to. We judge them by their essentially human qualities, regardless of whether or not they worship a particular god or none at all. And this, it seems to me, is because we all as human beings are engaged upon the same quest, namely that of happiness, and that this quest depends upon our being able to adjust ourselves to a frightening and incomprehensible environment. Now, this search for happiness involves certain fairly mundane pursuits. First of all, getting our daily bread, and secondly, at least going through the motions necessary to procreate the human race. But apart from this, we have a number of higher needs that must be satisfied. And one of these is to understand the nature of the world about us, and secondly, to find out what is our place in this world. And at one time, this search was unified. And years and years ago, the Bible was not only the best religion, but it was also the best science. But nowadays, we compartmentalize our search for the truth. And at the extreme, we have science, which has taken all the easy questions to answer. It accepts only those questions to which an experimental answer is in principle possible, and it works strictly within the confines of scientific materialism. Now, because it restricts itself to this very narrow field, it does not say that other things are unimportant. Far from it. It says it is not competent to judge these. And it leaves to other approaches the consideration of these immensely difficult, immensely important, and eternal questions that have bothered mankind throughout his history. And for these questions, we try to find answers in literature, poetry, drama, the arts, theater, and above all, in religion. Now, in an earlier and simpler day, men were satisfied with what the church would tell them. But we're no longer living in that simple age, and quite often your layman is better informed on technical matters than the man of the cloth. He no longer lives in terror of hell fire, and in this complicated age, he no longer can be satisfied with a simple faith. So consequently, we are all faced with an exceedingly complex cultural problem of how it has come about that a great many people no longer are able to believe in God. And as I see it, the factors involved are roughly as follows. First of all, the inevitable trend in any well-educated and democratic society is for people to think for themselves. Now, after 4 years of brainwashing here at UBC, you may doubt the truth of this statement, but let me assure you that this is our ultimate aim in getting together on this campus. It is our aim to challenge authority, to make you ask questions, and try to decide on the basis of evidence. Now, while this approach is characteristic of science, it is not exclusive to science. In fact, science got this approach from the humanists of the 14th and 15th centuries, who in turn got their inspiration from classical Greece. Scientists merely applied to their own particular questions the methods of these scholars, in particular Petrarch and other writers such as Boccaccio and Rabelais, and above all, that great scholar Erasmus. So apart from asking questions, we also have another factor in our present environment to contend with, namely the trend which has been going on to read the supernatural out of our interpretation of the world around us. Now, in this, science has played a very large part, but science didn't have the idea in the first place. It was thought up by the Epicureans and the Stoics, and it is merely a trend which has accelerated in recent years. Now, you put these two things together. The educational system, which encourages us to ask questions, and this increasing trend to read the supernatural out of events to which it formerly was considered to apply, and you have obviously a very dangerous situation for established orthodoxy, because there is no way in which you can place a limit on the direction these questions will take or upon the conclusions to which people may individually come. And the one that concerns us today is that obviously people are going to be driven to question the very existence of God, and if they question the existence of God, to question then how it is possible for there to be a Son of God. Now, the scholastics in the 11th and 12th centuries, 13th centuries, used to debate these questions, but they had a rule that only one side was going to win the debate. Now, nowadays, we can't set any such limits to our discussions, and it is probably evidence of the strength of the modern church that at least some of its members have come into the 20th century and have been debating this question about the possible death of God. This has been a strictly theological debate. Now, I take it that the concern for the Christian is to get across the message of the gospel. And as this message is the most powerful and important of any that have molded Western society, it is of paramount importance for those who are not themselves believers to see that this message is maintained. For whether or not we acknowledge it, our whole way of looking at life in Western society is molded by the message we have from Christianity and from Judaism, and they in turn trace their roots to the best of pagan thought and to the mystical religions of the East. Now, what we have to recognize is that there is no way in which one can prove the existence of God. This was decided as early as the 14th century, and although great minds have wrestled with this problem, I think it is generally recognized that it is a matter of faith or not having faith. And this is not a new problem. The early debates of the Christian church were immensely concerned with this exceedingly difficult question about the nature of the Son of God. And some of the most holy beliefs of the modern day were only established by the use of political maneuvering and strong-arm tactics that would have delighted the early bosses of Tammany Hall. If you consider the history of the ecumenical councils, in the first one, they declared the Arians heretics. In the third, they declared the Nestorians similarly suspect and drove them out and persecuted them. And in the fourth, they outlawed the Monophysites. And the consequence of this short-term gain for the winning side was the long-term loss of Christianity as a whole, because it exposed the Eastern Church to the Mohammedan conquest, and to this breakup of the early Christian Church, we can probably trace some of the tragic events which are going on today in the Lebanon. And what we have to be sure is that in facing the problems of present-day society, the church does not make similar mistakes. Now, with its history of pugnacity and tenacity of its beliefs, incompatible beliefs, it's unlikely that the church will reconcile itself to being sympathetic towards a purely secular interpretation of the gospel. It's equally unlikely, let's face it, that the large mass of unbelievers is going to be converted to the true faith. And I put it to you that such reconciliation is not even desirable. What is important is that people should honestly face up to the enormous complexity, the fantastic importance of these questions which concern us all, and that you should be given, not merely given, but forced to consider carefully these serious issues. And it seems to me that it is for everybody's advantage that we should have a strong church with a firm contemporary message, just in the same way that it's important for us to have a strong body of secular beliefs. But the two must interact, and the task of the church, surely, in these days, is to see that these powerful secular interests do not rush ahead on their own course in defiance of the laws of God and humanity.
I think I'll leave aside to Dr. Chitty perhaps questioning me on them the difficult matter of whether we are representing a tradition truly or caricaturing it. That would be a danger with my view of humanism. I might have a jaundiced view of it that isn't fair. Similarly, I think secular humanists often, in their view of Christianity, want to identify it closely with the Constantinian and now Roman Catholic Church, a kind of hierarchical, dictatorial one, rather than with the sectarian type of Christianity in the New Testament and since, which in fact values very highly democratic freedoms, and in fact some of our freedoms may well derive from those very motives. But I'd like to leave that aside and just pose, I'd like to know from Dr. Chitty, because it's interesting that we clearly want to maintain the same humane commitments, and my problem is that it seems to me that we can't just maintain them as a cultural heritage because we want them, that we can't sort of pretend they're just going to be available because we think they're nice, but that we need to have foundations for them. And from my talk, I'm basically posing the question, what you do with Nietzsche, who poses the problem just as well and better than I certainly did, namely that we have an abyss underneath us, that the artists and the writers and the poets are telling us that there is no intelligible order for our lives, and therefore it's foolish to pretend we're Christians when we clearly are post-Christians. So let's get rid of the culture that goes with the gospel and not try to keep the one without the other when it's denuded of its basis. And things like, and then the relativism that arises from that all we have left to believe is, like Ringer says, success and power, so let's pursue them. And that's my problem. So it isn't that I admire, and we are completely agreed in terms of what we are committed to as our commitment to the neighbor. I'm worried about the future of secular humanism more than I'm worried about the future of the gospel.
Now, is my microphone working?
There's a switch on it at the top.
Well, that might help.
Well, mine's forward.
Well, mine's all gummed up with...
I'm glad they gave it to the scientists.
It seems to be working a bit. In this age of technology, one has to be careful. My answer, at least my question to Clark, is simply this, that what he says is perfectly true, that we need a basis for our understanding, but a lot of people haven't got it. And what do you do about these people? They're perfectly prepared to accept the message, but they are not prepared to accept the theological foundation which is so important to the believer. Now, the point of my attack would simply be that if you have this large body of unbelievers, whom, after all, you have been trying to convert to the true faith for some time, how are you going to live with them? Is it not perhaps enough, and maybe it is, that you set the example from your own point of view, and that a lot of it will rub off on the heathen? Now, it seems to me that in the sort of society we live in, there is bound to be a huge diversity of point of view. And we just have to face up to it that a good many people are unable to justify their beliefs. Nevertheless, they hold them, and they act in accordance with the way that things seem to them. So, what are you going to do? Is the outlook for us pretty dim, Clark, unless we come over to holding your faith?
I think, if I read Heilbronner and these men correctly, who are not Christians, the outlook is very dim.
Well, the trouble is I don't read them, so I'm not aware of this.
What I'm getting at is that the dimness isn't just from my reading of the Bible, but from my reading of history, too, you see. And I'm worried about the future of Western man who is cut off from his metaphysical roots.
Well, I agree with you on that completely, that the dilemma of the present day is that we have destroyed the credibility of Christianity as a universal faith, and we have put nothing in its place. Mm. Now, I think we must face up to that. Now, can it be through updating or making more contemporary the message of the gospel or more appealing? Or do we have to rethink the whole thing? And if so, how do we start? Mm. And I frankly don't know, and I don't think these critics of the church have got an answer.
Could I, on the universal, I think we sometimes think pessimistically about the appeal of the Christian message to people because of Western Europe, and mostly Western Europe, where there has in fact been a decline. And whereas in the world at large, of course, the situation of the appeal of the gospel is very great. In fact, millions are becoming Christians all the time. Africa, for instance, it's estimated will have I think the figure is 100 million Christians by 1980. So I'm not as pessimistic about the possibilities, that is, of the attractiveness of the gospel to people. I think when we think of, modern man can't believe the gospel, I think that's really an autobiographical statement. I think that's what you feel yourself and many others
do. No, I'm saying that he's willing to believe the gospel, but not necessarily the theological basis.
Yeah, but the gospel is the framework in which the ethic makes sense. And I hold that believing the ethic apart from that isn't a rational thing, and that you're asking for more faith than I am of this audience.
Well, I don't think we can say that introducing the supernatural is necessarily a rational way of going about things. I would have said that this was an appeal to faith rather than to reason.
It would be if it were not so, as I believe, namely that the supernatural has communicated with us in human history, and that's the importance of Jesus for our own faith, that it roots in the meaning of him. But the reason I bring in the supernatural, the transcendent, is because historically, as you have already said, the confidence of Western man in the worthwhileness of life and humane values has in fact been rooted in transcendence, and that it is because this there has been a rupture of man from this confidence in the transcendent rootage of his own values that he has come to pieces. And I am simply proposing that we regain a sense of that transcendent and positing it on the basis of Jesus Christ, who is, according to the Christian evidence, transcendence in history. What worries me is that the reason secular humanists don't take the gospel seriously is because, A, they don't recognize the abyss that they are hovered over, and secondly, therefore, do not look very carefully at the biblical claim and reject what amounts to a caricature of it rather than the thing itself.
Well, this, I suppose, is where our fundamental disagreement is. I would say that plenty of people do accept the gospel message, mm-hmm. but evidently we disagree about what this message is. Do you have to accept the word, as you can read it in the Bible, literally? Or can you say that this was a wonderful document which was a reflection of the way men thought at the time? We have to at least recognize the division of opinions and nevertheless try to lead decent lives regardless of which ones we happen to hold.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, let me just say something about this, the matter of Jesus, because I feel, speaking with you, that it's clear that you want to have what amounts to a Christian, which I'm prepared to define as a humane, also ethic, without God or Jesus, and that it would be nice if it would stand on its own merits and be able to be sold as such. The reason I make so much about Jesus and the gospel is because of my pessimism that it can in fact stand and be sold as such, that unless it is rooted in precisely Jesus' claim to be the transcendent in history, the light of the world, and so on, if it can't be rooted in something like that, then it isn't rooted in anything, and it will tend to shrivel and die, as it is in fact doing in secular circles. So that your exalted ethic, which is very Christian, is more characteristic of, I don't know, of maybe a university setting, a setting which respects the Christian heritage in a very marvelous way. But out there in the world of secularism, in fact, people are really hurting because they don't know what their lives are for, and they're coming apart. And I worry about them. And I think for them, Jesus is the only thing that I would know to offer them. And that's what I do. But of course, I can't coerce it, and I just offer it.
But let me get in before the chairman cuts us off. This is, I agree completely with Clark, the difficulty that for some people, the appeal of the intellect is a reasonably satisfying way of grappling with these difficulties, except, of course, in times of intense human grief. But for most people, the appeal has to be through the emotions. And if these emotions have lost some of, at least, of their credibility, how are we to appeal to the great mass of humanity, which does, as I say, act on what it feels in its heart rather from what it knows in its head? Right, Mr. Chairman, we'll let you take over now.
On behalf of those whose names I know not, whose questions are before me, I want to begin. I understand more being assembled down there. I think we might alternate unless the questions are addressed specifically to one person, so I'll start with you, Dennis, on this first question. Let me just read it the way it's written. What is the place of education in humanism? What is the place of education in Christianity? Much of education today has isolated the intellect from the rest of life, e.g. emotion, will, love, passion. What is the humanist and Christian response to this? You start with that.
That's an excellent question. I think I'll set this to my class sometime. What is the place of education in humanism? It seems to me that most of us are exceedingly ignorant of our 2,000 years or more of cultural history. And I cannot emphasize the importance of increasing the amount of time, the amount of money, the amount of effort we put into teaching people about our cultural heritage. So more and more education at all levels, before university, at university, and in adult life. Much of education today has isolated the intellect from the rest of life. It has, very much so. And this is why we need to have the arts playing a far larger part in our daily lives. We should all of us, instead of going to lectures all day long, be taking in the other interesting activities which any university campus should offer. These are the important aspects of human existence: emotion, will, love, and passion. I'll hand it over now to Clark to take the last part of this question.
I remember reading J.S. Mill. He was reflecting on the twistedness of man, and he says, well, when we educate them all, it'll be all right. Which brings me back to the gospel. It isn't all right. And I think education has a problem because we are educating people in all the specialties and not having any framework in which they can be shown coherently to fit. And therefore, I'm back, it sounds like a broken record, but I'm back to the fact that the gospel has a framework in which one can really be educated because it holds things together and doesn't force us to move against what we know to be true, but to live in the light of what is true.
Let me turn then to the next question. This time we'll start with you. Would you comment on the relevance of simple faith? Is it not simplistic faith that is irrelevant?
Yes, I think that raises the matter of holistic faith too. One of the things I have felt about secular humanists is that very often it isn't holistic and that it doesn't, you know, I mean, that there is the other side to life, and the simple people who believe that it does satisfy the deep needs of, human beings. But for my part, I don't advocate Christianity to anybody here on the basis of uncritical thought. On the contrary, my argument today has been that critical thought will lead you to consider it, not to consider it, and that indeed I agree there is a simple faith that is not simplistic but is very thoroughly thought out. Indeed, the greatest thinkers in the West have frequently been those who have thought it out for us already.
Dennis, do you want to add anything on that one?
No, as usual, I agree with almost everything that Clark says.
All right. Will you comment first on this third question? Does the scientific method deal in proof, or does it rest upon the concept of accepting an hypothesis if it is shown not to be disproven? Please comment on the implications of your answer upon the question of proof of God's existence.
That is certainly a question I'll put on the final exams. I strongly suspect a member of my class sets this one up. I think I can recognize the writing. Well, yes. The answer is yes, that scientific method does depend upon hypothesis. And it does not, as so many people who are not in science believe, it does not claim to be able to reach the truth. It can only say, given this, that, or the other starting point, we find that this, that, or the other answer is or is not consistent with the argument as a whole. And so all we do is hold our ideas on faith in exactly the same way that Christians hold their beliefs in faith. There is no way in which in science you can prove anything to be true in the same way that you can establish proof in, say, mathematics or geometry. Because in all cases dealing with the real world, you have to start with certain assumptions. And it is these assumptions that people are perfectly entitled to take or leave alone. And I'd like this one back, please.
Can I comment on that? Yeah, I'd like to just say one thing on that. I like that answer very much. And I'd just like to clarify something that was said earlier then against the gospel, namely about something about proving God in the Middle Ages. And then the point also about the kind of political machinery that went on at the Nicaea, you know, to eliminate. I'd like to dissociate with all of that. My understanding of Christianity that it is that it needs to be thought out, that it doesn't suffer from being thought out, that if it can be falsified, it should be falsified and rejected. My claim is that it is not yet falsified, and that, as a matter of fact, it has some rather good reasons to believe in it.
Let me turn then to the next question. I observe that it is approximately 20 after, in case any of you need to leave.
Could I just answer that? I have never said, and I doubt if anybody else, certainly not my acquaintance, would say that Christianity has been falsified. They would merely say that it is impossible to prove it to be true, and it is therefore a matter of faith.
Fine. All right. We'll ask Professor Pinnock, to comment first on this one. Does humanism have a basis beyond culture and convention?
My thesis has been no, so I'll pass it over.
Could I see that question?
While he's reading it, my argument is that the Christian and humane and humanist way of looking at things is the cultural heritage of the metaphysics and theological framework of the gospel, and that is its true origin, and that I'm worried that it will dry up when those origins are denied.
Well, I would agree, too, that once those origins are called in question, then you have no way of establishing anything. But I don't think in this life we can establish anything. All we can do is take a certain view, which happens to fill certain needs and to be in harmony with contemporary thought. And so, if you like, humanism does not have a basis beyond culture and convention, but it has a very long history of culture and convention, and it seems to fulfill certain human needs.
The next question is specifically addressed in the first instance to Dr. Chetty. You have said that it is impossible to prove the existence of God. On the other hand, has anyone disproved the existence of God? The events of history show us clearly that more knowledge does not mean that we are wiser. The Bible is an objective book of history under the revelation of God. If people deny the existence of God, a vacuum is created in their lives once many of their secular objectives are realized.
I think I could have written that myself. I agree with it completely. And this is the dilemma of the times. For a lot of people, the meaning of life has disappeared. How do we put it back? I don't know. All we can do is face these issues fairly and squarely and see if between us we can give different versions of the possible truth, and somewhere people will be able to find a place where their beliefs will fit in.
Of course, from a Christian standpoint, and part of the reach out is that we believe that it is possible to take Jesus seriously when he speaks of having life more abundant and being the light of the world, and that in fact you can in fact elude that relativism and flux and be united with God who is really there.
I suppose the only part I would disagree with is this. The Bible is an objective book of history and under the revelation of God. This is the question we're here to discuss. Could it not be an intensely important human document written in the most superb language that we have ever come across and standing in its own right as summing up the best in human experience? I don't know the answer to this. I merely say this is a legitimate way of looking at it.
The next seems to me an observation addressed to you rather than a question, but you may wish to comment. Dr. Chetty, it might be important to raise the point of his, presumably Professor Pennick, underlying assumption of original sin, quote, the underlying abyss. The secular humanists believe that man's evil is a consequence of social, cultural origins.
Well, if Clark wants to talk about his views on sin, I'd be delighted to hear them. I don't think he has raised this point.
Let me just say this, yeah. And this will help. In my opinion, the concept of sin being original, that is, being endemic to the human condition throughout all ages, is a social view, that in fact it is transmitted, it is taught. We are ready learners, but nonetheless, we are taught to be self-centered, and I take that to be the most empirical thing about Christianity and the least empirical thing about the kind of humanism that Huxley, though not Dr. Chitty, had.
I think I'll go along with that answer.
Good. All right. The next one is addressed to Dr. Pinnock. Granted that the modern secular man does not have the comforting dogma of Christianity to base his humanism on, I am not certain at all that man cannot feel comfortable with moral relativism. Does it not seem possible, rather, that this morality, emphasizing individual values, can satisfy the ultimate problems of man? I must say, I'm not entirely clear.
I think I grasp it. No, I think it's good. First of all, As far as Christians having comfortable dogma, often I find it very uncomfortable indeed. Bearing the cross in the world is not my idea of comfort. Sometimes I wish God were dead. So really, it has nothing to do with essentially comfort or discomfort. I hope that's true. Yes, I do. I hope, for instance, that a secular humanist is able, because of its intrinsic merits, to hold to a golden rule and other aspects of a humane and Christian ethic, I find, however, as I read secular humanists like Kafka, Nietzsche, Sartre, Camus, Beckett, you name them, that they can't. And therefore, I have, in a sense, I have nothing to say to the secular humanist who can, like my dialogue partner, but I'm going to go on saying it to the people who can't, because I think they're more numerous.
All right, the next one I think is addressed by implication to you, Professor Chitting. Granting your refutation of Christianity as the only answer, what option to it are you proposing for those of us who agree with you?
Well, in the first place, I do not claim, I certainly would make no such claim of refuting Christianity. I don't think that is possible. I can merely say that it is largely a matter of faith, in fact, entirely a matter of faith guided by reason, whether or not one accepts it. And as for the option, this is the great dilemma to which I have no answer. Absolutely none. All I can say is that we do try to act towards one another as good human beings in our understanding of the term, and that we have to work it out empirically from there. But don't let me give you the impression that I think this is an easy task at all. It's much easier if only we all had the faith. But the history of man's progress throughout time is that this faith is very difficult to come by universally. And so we do have this dilemma.
My experience, though, with non-Christian students is to say to them that it would be easier to come by this faith if they looked at the evidence. And that, in fact, they don't. You know, they don't really take seriously the biblical claim. They don't read the Gospels. They don't study the documentary evidence for it and all. And thus, they are prematurely unbelieving. I wouldn't reject faith as impossible until they, like you, perhaps, have, in fact, done that homework.
I'm less sanguine than you that doing homework is the way in which one gets to the truth.
I have a question here in which is divided, one to each of you, and one to both of you. Dr. Pinnock, I'll read all of it so that you'll see it in the context. Dr. Pinnock, is God merely a firm basis for Christian humanism? Dr. Chitty, is our quest, I thought at first it said guest, obviously it isn't, is our quest merely ultimately for happiness? And then to both of you, what are our lives ultimately for? Dr. Pinnock.
Beautiful. No. First question was, is God merely a framework, a basis for the worthwhileness of life? My answer is, of course, he is not, though he is not less. And my answer is, what is he? Exactly that. He is a living person with whom one can walk life's journey and live in living fellowship. And of course, I suppose part of the reason we believe in him is not only because I think it satisfies our human life need for meaning, not only because it makes sense of Jesus Christ best, but also because I have met him. He's real. That's my answer to my part. Did you want me to read yours? Likewise, is our quest merely ultimately for happiness was yours.
Well, this is a matter of definition, I suppose, because different people would have a different idea of what happiness is. And yeah. In the broad sense, yes, I would say that happiness is going to come if we can find a satisfactory way of living our lives. Then there's something more for me on that, isn't there?
That was the question for both?
Yes.
What are our lives ultimately for? That's the one for us both.
Well, this is where the Christian has a message, which is a good one, absolutely a magnificent answer, and it's one which the doubters are unable to accept. And I think one has to be clear about this, that it is a matter of doubt, and that even the greatest theologians in the past have usually started with doubts, and as Clark says, the more you study the problems involved, the more likely you are to be sympathetic to the answers.
So I don't think there is any answer to this last question.
Well, I have it too. What are our lives ultimately for? The difficulty of answering that from a Christian perspective is, of course, that it does presuppose the ability to stand where, as if God exists, where he stands in order to understand his motives in the creation of the world. So far as I can tell from my walk with him and from the gospel and from the Bible, what it hints about it, it seems that he wants a human community of love and freedom, a people who will indeed relate to each other in the way that we are seeking to defend today, and this hasn't come out yet, and indeed a new humanity for which he has a new order in the end.
The next question is not indicated to whom it's addressed. If Christianity has as its basis the love of one's neighbor, then how is this reconciled with the treatment of the Indian empires found by the European Christians? With the approval of the Pope, these empires were destroyed, the people enslaved in the name of converting them to Christianity. Is the Christian love of one's neighbor reserved for other Christians?
Of course not. And I do not deny that things have happened in history in the name of Christ. Jesus himself faced that. He said, "Not everyone that calls me Lord, Lord shall enter into the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father." Those that act like infidels in the name of Christ are infidels no less. And I defend nothing of what they have done. I defend and speak only of the Spirit of Jesus, which has been amply demonstrated in history as well, alongside these caricatures of it. We are maybe I personally think we are maybe the primitive church. 2,000 years is nothing in the light of our evolutionary past. Perhaps we're just getting started. There are certainly some very foolish moves. Of the billion people in the world who think of themselves as Christians, there are certainly some who don't seem to be that, and I have no interest in defending that. Jesus said you can lose your saltiness as well as keep it. So what I'm advocating is that Christianity can be, though it need not be, a revolutionary salting force in the earth. And if I look at the world today, we need that more than anything else. And it may just be then in this debate that if there is no answer from the secular humanist side, then the Christian answer is needed more and more, because we're all going to perish without this ethic.
Do you wish to comment that, or shall I go on to the next question?
No, that's a magnificent reply.
What about the problem of the personal? If there is no personal God, do we have a foundation of our own personhood as man?
That's obviously one for Clark. Mere scientists couldn't tackle that.
Well, that's been the thrust of the entire talk together, and my point is already clear, that it seems to me the most adequate foundation for the meaningfulness of our interpersonal lives is the gospel. And I recognize that Dr. Chitty wants that same worthwhileness without it, and we are basically probing whether you can have it without it. He clearly does have it without it, but I'm wondering if it can possibly be something we offer those who doubt whether they can have it. It isn't really a question, you know, it's come up a lot that I would believe the basis of Christianity if I could accept it, whereas the shape of the dialogue seems to be I can't accept the proposed humanist base for that, and that I have trouble of faith with it.
Is Christianity of the New Testament historically viable? That is it reasonable, underlined, to believe that Jesus Christ rose from the dead by historical analysis?
I believe yes. I'd have to take some time to show that. But suffice it to say that the event Jesus Christ is, I think, the best documented in terms of manuscript evidence, ancientness of the manuscripts, etc., of anything, and that the event that happened in the first century that sparked off the Christian movement requires explanation. I think it is best explained by its own claim to resurrection. But, of course, that is not a coercive. I wouldn't say that's accepting it by faith. On the other hand, I certainly don't think it proven in the strong sense that we both reject proof.
My answer would be no, and that this part, the resurrection, which is so important to the Christians, is not all that important to those who do not share the Christian faith, and they can accept the message of the gospel without this.
The next question. It appears that the growth of Christianity is taking place, as you say, in Africa and other developing nations, and declining in industrialized Western nations. Would this not indicate
that it is the disadvantaged people, desperate people, that are taking to religion as a crutch, like a drowning man clinging to a straw.
Yes, except that it isn't true. In North America, there was a rather massive Jesus movement among industrial youth who were sick of industrialism and all its plasticity. And secondly, in the USSR, the problem with Marxism is finding one, and that there is, in fact, a very large spiritual movement among those people back to Christian roots, Solzhenitsyn, for example. So it isn't true. Is it?
Dennis, do you want to add anything?
I would say that the problem for the developing nations is the same as the problem for the disadvantaged in industrial Western society, that they desperately need to find some purpose to life. Yeah. And that the more sophisticated your society becomes, the more and more difficult it is to accept a simple faith which was adequate in the first century AD, but has not, in my opinion, been made into a strong contemporary message for the 20th century.
Our last question. Contemporary man and woman struggle for food, shelter, peace, and justice. How do each of you feel about a way through your humanism to achieve these real needs of people?
Well, my answer is through taking Jesus Christ seriously. He called for a people who would regard themselves as a servant people in the midst, who would in fact scale down their own consumption and greed and make sharing with other people. So that in the gospel there is a most passionate, indeed more passionate than I have ever been able to make myself, but towards which I strive, a passionate commitment to this problem. And let Mother Teresa stand for the kind of Christianity in which I have faith.
Again, I would agree, as I do about in nearly everything with Clark, that if you can put over this sort of thing through the Christian message, so much the better. My question is, do you think this is a practical proposition without a very considerable degree of reinterpretation of the message? Now, if we go out and say, I'm afraid of, I may be a little wrong on my phraseology, but build not up treasures on earth, build them up in heaven. I'm sorry, I've mauled, yes, mauled the gospel.
Acceptable. Now, better than some translations.
Now, supposing we take this seriously and see how we're going to fit this into the modern structure of society. It's a really tough job, but I personally believe this is something we might very well be driven to have to take more seriously. And this is part of our contemporary dilemma, that we are using up our resources, we're an extremely wasteful society, we're using energy out of all proportion to our numbers in the world, and maybe we're going to have to realize that there is a totally different way of looking at life than that of our materialistic Western society. And to get back to the primitive message of the gospel seems to me to be absolutely essential. But what I'm saying is that if you tie it to a set of beliefs which a lot of people find incredible, you may succeed in working against the very thing that you are so passionately trying to promote.